What we're seeing across the world is that the emerging markets and developing countries, let's not forget them, are going to be coming out of this pandemic with a lot more damage.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. Today, a discussion between two distinguished economists on what they know and what they don't know about the global economy.
My worry is we don't know the true extent of the problem, since a lot of actions during the pandemic have worked towards masking the problems.
It's been almost 2 years now since the coronavirus began to disrupt our lives and economies. So are things really getting better, or will the disruption linger? In this episode, IMF Chief Economist Geeta Gopinath asks Raghuram Rajan where he thinks this is all going. Rajan is a former governor of the Bank of India and currently the Catherine Dussac Miller Distinguished Service Professor of Finance at Chicago Booth. He's also the author of several books on various aspects of the global economy.
And most importantly, Raghu was the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund between 2003 and 2006. Raghu is quite simply a consummate scholar, a visionary, and who has had a profound impact in academia, in the policy world, and pretty much on anyone who cares about the world of economics and finance. So Raghu, it's a real pleasure to have you join us today. The screen is yours.
Thank you, Geeta, and thanks for having me. And of course, I was chief economist at a time when things were very, very benign. In fact, even Argentina was in the process of recovery at that time. And of course, you are living in really unprecedented times and having to work through it. I congratulate the IMF on pushing for a much broader vaccine strategy. It seems to me the failure of vaccine distribution to many parts of the developing world are a taint on global cooperation. And I'm glad that the IMF has made serious efforts on pushing large countries to remedy that. Now, let me talk about a couple of things which are quite important. Clearly in industrial countries, we've seen Delta and supply bottlenecks slowing growth in the third quarter, and Delta is picking up, or the virus is picking up again in Eastern Europe. But you know, there is a sense that with pent-up savings, the fact that many households, certainly in the United States, have brought down their debt levels, and if the Democrats pass the packages, there will be at least the prospect of fiscal transfers for a substantial period of time, as well as the infrastructure package. There is a sense that demand is strongly supported. And even though higher inflation is eroding real incomes, and there is the likelihood, the Fed already moved yesterday, of central bank action to slow demand, on net, we have greater risks of overheating rather than of falling back into secular stagnation. And so I would argue that to some extent, you know, the views on inflation are dichotomous. You know, one view is that everything is transitory. You know, when all this dies down, we'll go back to the slow and low inflation. I guess the IMF coined the term lowflation of the post-global financial crisis times. In other words, a belief that this time is not different, while many others, including me, believe that this time is different, especially given the massive fiscal support, both post-pandemic and continuing to today. Now, on inflation, I believe the aspects that are particularly different this time is the strength of the labor market. And it's not just because of transitory factors like, you know, unemployment benefits or pandemic concerns or women staying out of the labor force. There does seem to be a big sort of shift in worker attitudes. There are more and more people in the US, in the UK, who don't like high contact, low skilled jobs at low wages, and they worry about career progress. And that's reflected in the difficulty that people have of attracting workers to certain kinds of jobs, especially the lower skilled ones. There's also the fact that the jobs aren't where the people are. In the US, for example, you see that New York City still has unemployment of close to 10% because high contact services haven't opened up, while many other places, employers are crying out for workers. They simply cannot find them. This also means there's a transition required from waiter to welder, and that doesn't happen overnight. These may well be transitory because of the goods market has recovered faster than the services market, but the kind of transitions that might be required may take longer. And of course, when coupled with changing attitudes, it may be longer for a time in which inflationary expectations could get entrenched. But I would say the biggest reason to believe that there is a changed environment, a changed regime relative to the post-global financial crisis regime, is that on a number of issues, we have become more supportive of effectively higher inflation. Labor policy is much more geared towards workers, minimum wages in the United States, more union support. Minimum wages have been going up, as you know. And post-pandemic, there is a sense that we must do more for workers, a public sort of view. And I think this will help keep wages higher. Of course, globalization has turned to more protectionism. Globalization was a force in keeping prices down. It's going to be less of a force today. Central banks have changed policy attitudes and in fact, frameworks, as the Fed has, from the post-global financial crisis situation, partly as a result of not being able to achieve the inflation targets. For example, the Fed says rather than minimize deviations, it's going to minimize shortfalls from full employment. It's not going to be proactive on inflation. It's going to be reactive. These are big changes, and that does mean a more inflationary environment. But the biggest, I think, change is the fact that many now believe there are no constraints on fiscal policy, and therefore fiscal policy has become much more expansionary, partly because of economists like Olivier Blanchard, your predecessor, who emphasized the low level of interest rates and the ability to spend more. Of course, Olivier is, I think, against the level of spending today, but he set the conditions for people to think more about expansionary fiscal policy. In a sense, central banks have been surprised by the extent of fiscal response.
Thanks, Raghu. As expected, you kicked us off by talking about the most interesting issues that we have on our plate. So let me push you some on the first one, which is on the inflation discussion. And I guess here we're talking about the US and maybe the euro area and some of the advanced economies here. So precisely what do you have in mind when you say we're in a different regime for inflation and it's not about transitory, even if it's, several quarters transitory, it's not that situation. Are you talking about, say, inflation in the US going back to what it was in the 1970s and staying incredibly elevated? And requiring some very strong action to bring that down. So we're talking about 7%, 8% inflation. So I guess that's the first question. What exactly do you have in mind for your inflation views? The second is in terms of the forces, right? So yes, indeed, we are seeing changes in the labor market. We are seeing a push for minimum wages go up and maybe a higher bargaining power at certain levels of wage skills. But again, as we know, these are all relative price movements, right? So we have wages of some going up. So what we know, for instance, just looking at least what on companies that are listed on the stock market, if we look at their earnings and their profitability, it remains extremely high in all these parts of the world, right? So you could very well see wages going up, but then that's just more redistribution away from corporate profits to workers. And that should not then necessarily generate a wage price spiral because companies have the ability to absorb it. And that's part of what we saw before this crisis, which is we saw that there was sensitivity in wage inflation to the output gap and to the tightness in the labor market. What we did not see was then that being passed through into prices. And the argument was that there was a big buffer with markups and higher profitability. And anything, and this crisis seems to lead to the, you know, suggest that we are certainly moving towards higher automation, more concentration with all the small guys out. So, you know, that force remains over there. So that's the second part. And the third is on issues like globalization, again, another real issue, which is the fact that we end up with a less integrated world, maybe less competition, less sharing of technology. Those have real consequences. The question is, how does that then affect inflation, right? Because we think of inflation as a consequence. It's a nominal concept. It's about the stance of monetary and fiscal monetary policy, especially, for instance, and of course, combined with fiscal policy. Now, before the pandemic hit, we thought these forces still played a role and played a very important role in driving inflation dynamics because we have the zero lower debt bond problem, which is that when your real interest rates are very low and they're negative, you know, monetary policy can't give all the stimulus that's needed to bring inflation back up. But in the opposite situation, where if the problem indeed is greater protectionism, because of which that's going to put pressure on real interest rates to go up and then also put pressure on inflation, monetary policy is far more effective in being able to raise interest rates as much as you want. So what is your view then in terms of, you know, which parts of these arguments do you think break down and why do you think that we're in this, in a different regime?
Great set of questions. And look, I don't know which regime we are in. Are we the 70s, the 60s, or some other regime? I think only time will tell. What I'm not saying we will get double-digit levels of inflation. I am saying that we will exceed the inflation targets by significant amounts for sustained periods, and we'll have to bring it back to target, which means tighter policy. What I am worried about is that markets don't seem to be anticipating this tightening, and that there are many assets which are priced as if rates will stay low for really long. I mean, you know, in this environment of potential overheating, seeing 10-year real interest rates in the US around minus 1% tells me something's not adding up. Either my economics is faulty or the markets are either sort of valuing Fed credibility significantly and believing that the Fed will get things under control after a very short spike, or they believe something else will happen. And you can go through the list of scenarios. One scenario where the Fed starts raising interest rates, asset prices collapse, and we're back to the need for accommodation and low interest rates. So, I mean, there are various bad scenarios one could think of. I would argue that given what has happened in the past, the temptation for the Fed will be to stay on the sidelines longer than it would if it wasn't sort of informed by what happened post-global financial crisis and by the extraordinary fiscal effort that has taken place now. If the Fed was to, in a sense, pull the plug on the economy and see it sort of slow down considerably, I can bet you every politician will be baying for the blood of the governors of the Fed. We spent enormous amounts of resources and enormous amounts of effort in getting this fiscal deal together. And you guys, by raising interest rates, have just brought the economy down. And you know, so I don't think any Fed governor wants to be there. And therefore, I would say the temptation will be to be more accommodative than you would otherwise be. I wouldn't say it's politically determined, but it's at the back of their mind is the political consequence of being of the risk that the markets react too much and sentiment collapses and we're back to square one. So I think they'll wait longer than potentially they should. Last point, I think post-global financial crisis, some of my colleagues have written about it. I wrote about it in a book. Part of the reason for low demand was, and actually I think the first clear enunciation of this was from the IMF. part of the reason for low demand was the distribution of income. And, you know, when income moves from the poor to the rich, if it gets more skewed, the rich have a lower marginal propensity to consume, and therefore consumption is less easy to sustain. What we've seen in the post-pandemic response is the reverse. And so I would say that's a good thing. It's good that wages and incomes are going up at the lower end, but it also makes demand, in a sense, stronger and more sustained than it was, you know, post-global financial crisis. And that's another element that we should think about. We should celebrate the fact that income is equalizing a little more, but we should worry about the inflationary consequences.
I think, you know, regardless how we feel about the inflation numbers and where it might jump around, I think we all are in agreement that the markets seem to be priced to perfection, which means that it doesn't take much in terms of accidents or surprises to have some pretty big consequences, at least in financial markets, and then again, the spillovers to the real economy. So that I agree on. And of course, I think the point you made also that you said, you know, you raised the concern that the Fed might be behind the curve effectively because of all of this new environment that we are in. But if I, you know, there's a question that came up on Q&A, which would be, I guess, an argument that might be made by some central bankers, which is that the reason we're being so incredibly cautious is because we want to solve the problem that we've also been fighting the past decade, which is of too low inflation.
Yep.
So maybe this is not a bad idea to actually bring inflation up to levels we would be happy with, which would then help us in the long run. And so, you know, I think at this point, we're all very focused on the big numbers that we're seeing. But again, if you look at long-term inflation expectations, if you look at the past decade, they're all pointing towards inflation not being in the ranges that would make would make central bank policy that effective if things were to go bad in the future. So that's one point. And then last, I agree with you. I mean, there are all these forces, again, of globalization and so on that can have these kinds of effects. But we need that. You need the piece which also says that all these real factors will have big nominal consequences. And again, I think that while that argument was easier to make when the problem was of too low inflation, I think it's harder to make when you have too high inflation.
Let me just take the discussion to a somewhat different point. I mean, look, first, not everything is on the table is inflationary, right? I think there are two other effects we shouldn't minimize. One is, of course, the financial sector. We talked about it. What if asset prices sort of react to the prospect of higher inflation? Nominal interest rates go up at the long end, and asset prices, especially of tech stocks, come down to earth. Cryptocurrencies, $2.5 trillion. You know, what are they worth? They're pricing in some sort of future where everybody uses cryptos and cryptos make money. I don't know what that is. I can visualize some uses, but that's another concern. But I would also point to, the effect. We are primed for a low nominal interest rate, low real interest rate world. And what if both sort of move up? And our fiscal situation is not to be, you know, you shouldn't forget that we have a lot of debt outstanding on the fiscal side. And so immediately the response is, well, it's long-term debt. It's not. That's the reality of what's been happening over the last few years. Take, for example, the UK, and I was just amazed by these numbers. Average maturity of debt, 15 years, right? Now, but average maturity, there's some 30, 40, 50, even console bonds in the UK. And there's a lot of short maturity stuff also. So when you look at median maturity, it goes down to 11 years. That's still fine, right? 11 years means 1/11 turns over every year, is repriced at new interest rates. Not too much of a worry. But then you subtract what the Bank of England has bought, because that essentially converts longer-term debt into overnight debt. And the median maturity comes down to 4 years. Now, 4 years median maturity means a significant part of your debt is repricing every year, especially because there's a lot more short-term debt concentrated there. And it turns out if interest rates go up 100 basis points, almost all the fiscal sort of normalization that they have goes out of the window, offset by these interest rates. Now, that's for the UK. For the US, you start with average maturity 65 months, okay? And then do all the subtractions and get down to median maturity, et cetera. My suspicion is the US has a lot more short-term debt waiting to be repriced if interest rates go up. That has fiscal consequences. And, you know, we're adding to the fisc right now with all the spending that's taking place. But who knows what happens when these rates go up and what kinds of political reactions there are. The broader point I'm making is I sort of agree with you that we're not talking about hyperinflation. We're talking about an inflationary environment. But what I'm saying is we're used to a non-inflationary environment. And some of the adjustments we will make in the process may create forces that we haven't been used to, essentially deficits that are harder to finance and larger than we expected, and financial market reactions that will require, I mean, the leveraging that's happened in the financial markets, you know, yes, outside of the banks, but we'll find out who's been swimming naked when financial market prices adjust.
Given what you just said, do you think that emerging market policymakers are maybe then a little, maybe too sanguine about the risks of very large tantrums in financial markets and so on that could emanate from the US? And if, and given your, you've been a central banker, what would be your policy advice at this point in an environment like this for emerging markets?
Well, emerging markets don't have the credibility that industrial countries have. Partly because of politics that have been fractured over time. Now, emerging markets have done a lot to build up stronger institutions, inflation targeting central banks, and so on. And you can see, for example, in a country like Brazil, the tension this is causing, right? On the one hand, on the political side, spending is taking place, breaking some of the fiscal rules that were in place. On the financial or the monetary side, the central bank is saying, therefore, we're going to raise interest rates. So unlike the industrial countries where there is sort of cooperation between the central bank and the political establishment, at least at this point in trying to get the country out of the trouble, these different sort of pressures on the political side and on the monetary side, given that Brazil has an inflation targeting central bank, are creating a pretty substantial tension in Brazil with interest rates moving up pretty rapidly and inflation, of course, also moving up. So I think that what we're seeing across the world is that the emerging markets and developing countries, let's not forget them, are going to be coming out of this pandemic with a lot more damage. And the damage, you know, is in the informal sector, it is in the lower middle class, and therefore it's not so easily observable. When I talk about the problems in India, people sort of essentially criticize me for being negative. And my worry is we don't know the true extent of the problem since a lot of actions during the pandemic have worked towards masking the problems.
Raghu, did you want to weigh in on your, you know, central bankers? What should they do if you're an emerging market central banker?
Well, I think at this point, if you're a central banker, you have a pretty clear mandate and you should worry about that mandate. The problem to some extent is your temptation is not to pull the rug to, again, similar to the Fed, you don't want to be accused of hurting the recovery. And the reality is the recovery, you know, after the initial rebound is going to be slower.
Okay, Raghu, sorry, I'm pushing you on this, but what would you want them to do?
I'm not disagreeing with that approach. Partly, again, you don't know the extent of the disinflationary forces that will emerge down the line from your own economy because there's more damage under the hood. And so you don't want to react to the rebound, which is happening, which suggests strong growth, and with the supply chain problems, which will potentially elevate prices in certain areas. You will wait and see what happens beyond that. Now, again, I would say we don't really know how much damage has been done because a lot of it has been covered up. I believe there is substantial damage, and therefore, medium run in these countries, there will be more disinflationary forces rather than inflationary forces. But we don't know. And I think they will play for time so long as they don't look ludicrously out of sync with the current outlook.
On the question of debt, you raise the point that debt levels are incredibly high. It's true, we're at historic levels. Debt to GDP is, public debt to GDP is 100%. And we also have central, and the other point you made was that the bloated central bank balance sheets, like you said, everybody's been buying, central banks are buying government debt. So two questions. One, you know, what is the best strategy for advanced economies and emerging and developing economies to reduce the public debt vulnerabilities? And second, are you concerned about central banks having very large balance sheets and that could affect their ability to do sound monetary policies and so on?
Let me start with, what one might want to do. I think one would want to do the exact opposite of what modern monetary theory would suggest. Don't finance the government budget anymore with effectively money printing. Issue 30-year bonds, 50-year bonds, 100-year bonds right now while the markets are still accepting of it. And lengthen the maturity of your balance sheet. Of course, it might come at the expense of some investor on the other side. But if you want to stabilize government balance sheets, lengthen maturities as rapidly as you can while the QE is still on, while you can sell the debt. And for God's sake, don't focus certainly on shortening those maturities. From the central bank perspective, buy shorter maturities right now rather than buying longer maturities. From the central bank perspective, so I think there are two issues here. One is what Viral Acharya and I call liquidity dependence, which is, the view was when the central banks expand their balance sheets, that, this is a good thing, that this provides a lot of liquidity to the market. In a sense, it's the Friedman rule, right? Supply liquidity because there's no cost to supplying liquidity and do a lot of it so long to the point that the market is satisfied. My worry is that the market is never satisfied. That what happens is the liquidity that the central bank provides is first offset by the way the commercial banks finance that liquidity, typically by issuing wholesale deposits. And you can see it over QE1, QE2, QE3. That's how it was financed. But a wholesale deposit is a claim on liquidity under certain conditions, right? And so what we're seeing, interestingly, is these liquidity episodes where liquidity sort of dries up in the markets. We saw it in September of 2019, way before the pandemic. And of course, we saw it in spades, the dash for cash, in March of 2020. And so our argument is the liquidity that is supplied is offset by a huge number of new claims on that liquidity, so much so that it's very hard to pull back. Today, Daryl Duffy and others, when they talk about the excess liquidity in these markets, are saying, let's supply more. And of course, conditional on where we are, supplying more makes sense. But what we're saying is that is going to create more demands. And the private markets are never going to have enough. They basically, liquidity sitting on a bank balance sheet is, needs to be used. Otherwise, the banks are letting a resource lay idle, and they do use it. But that means that nothing is really left when push comes to shove. And so I believe that we're ratcheting up the levels of central bank balance sheets. We had $800 billion, I think, pre-global financial crisis in 2018-19. A balance sheet four times that size was not enough to prevent liquidity shortfalls. And now, of course, we've got significantly bigger than that, but I think the private markets will adjust, making it more difficult for us to go back. But we should. I don't think it's the central bank's role to continue providing liquidity, and the private markets should get used to not having so much around, but it's easier said than done because the private markets have become dependent. So, you know, bottom line, I think quantitative tightening should happen at some point, but it has to be handled very carefully because it's not as easy as we think.
Thanks, Raghu. This is a really interesting point because, yes, this was a view that was put out, which is that there's such a huge demand for safe assets that central bank liabilities provide those safe assets. But what you're saying is that that just feeds into then greater demand for you know, creates other kinds of liabilities that feeds into greater demand for safe assets. And it's a bit endless. But thank you. I think we're out of time, but you know, we've covered a lot of ground. So thanks, Raghu.
Thank you, Geeta. Thanks for having me.
That was IMF Chief Economist Geeta Gopinath and Raghuram Rajan in a conversation held during the IMF's Jacques Polak Annual Research Conference earlier this month. You'll find a webcast of the entire event at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on Twitter at imf_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.